Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we have got an interview with Damaris Smith, man in charge at the National Football League Players Association. We'll talk to him about the email leaks and more. But first, all right, so I was, engaging in some form of journalism on Monday night, making some calls, talking to some people. And I got on the call and was talking to somebody about Kyrie. Somebody knew some things about what was going on there. And what I was told was that Kyrie, well, I don't even need to lead up to you how I was told, because Shams Charania told the world what I was told. Shams writes for The Athletic. I know he's getting the blues for this because people are accusing him of engaging in stenography, but basically just taking down whatever it is that Kyrie Irving said. But Kyrie Irving, from what I had heard, and this, real talk, Kyrie Irving says that what he's doing right now with this whole thing and the vaccine, it isn't really about him. He's taking a stand. And he says that he is speaking, and the way Shams Charania put it, I didn't hear it in these words, but is that he is a voice for the voiceless. But this dude, whether you think somebody else came up with it or not, I don't know. But it is my understanding that Kyrie legitimately believes that he is doing this for people who are losing their jobs because of vaccine mandates, and they need somebody to speak for them. Now, I feel fairly confident that all of you who are listening to this right now appreciate the irony of that statement. And the irony of that statement, I don't even know if I want to call it twofold or if I want to say that it just covers everything about this, because there are two parts of this, but they wind up being everything. So what's ironic to me? Number one, it is ironic that Kyrie sees himself as being a voice to the voiceless on this matter, except we ain't heard his voice. Think about that for a second. That man is representing as the voice for other people without actually using his voice. I don't really understand how that works, but here we are. The other part is, in the face of these vaccine mandates, and Kyrie believes that he is the voice for the voiceless. Everybody, I don't know, man. I can't speak for the experience that you have in your life. I can't speak for the experience that you have within yourself, right? Perhaps you are an unvaccinated person who is at risk of losing your job because of a vaccine mandate that you don't wish to comply with, right? And perhaps you are that person and you feel that nobody is speaking for you. You feel that you kind of all here, all alone by yourself, and nobody's saying anything. Maybe that's the way you feel. I, however, feel like I have heard plenty from the unvaccinated population, plenty from the people who feel like they might lose their jobs. Plenty, I tell you, plenty. Sorry, I just don't feel like that's an unspoken for group of people. In fact, if we wanted to take this just a step further, Andrew Wiggins, just the other day, when he ultimately decided that he would rather get paid than prove a point, he spoke up for the unvaccinated people who feel like they're going to lose their jobs in the name of this. So what you talking about, man? What is this? Now, look, we haven't talked here on this podcast since the call was made by the Nets that Kyrie could not be a part-time player. They made that decision. I don't really know mechanically how it got to the point that that decision was made. I do know, though, that that decision was ultimately unavoidable. There was really no way around this. I actually thought that Joe Tsai, the owner of the Nets, made a mistake when he went and got that exemption to make the Nets practice facility seen as an office building or something like that. But either way, by doing that, the vaccination requirement for Kyrie went out the window. And what I feel like Joe Tsai basically did in that moment was basically a form of splitting the baby, right? Like, that's what he is. Like, he cut the baby in half. You can't cut the baby in half. Not how it works. That's not how it goes. It would never be sustainable that Kyrie could only play for that team half the time. In fact, I like to kind of sit around and imagine what it must have been like when somebody came up to Steve Kerr and was like, well, what if Kyrie just plays half the games? By the way, half the games, and they roll games. So you know what that means? That would mean that you are trusting Kyrie to hit you with, all right, man, I see y'all when I get there. I meet y'all there. Right? Now, I'm just asking you this, right? I'm just asking you. So you imagine that you out somewhere or whatever, you had dinner and y'all got another spot that y'all going to or whatever, and Kyrie is a member of the party, and you're like, hey, Kyrie, man, we about to go out for drinks. And Kyrie hits you with, all right, cool, I'll meet you there. You think Kyrie going to meet you there? Like, do you really think that? Do you feel like after that's been said that you need to save a seat at the bar for Kyrie? Because I feel like Kyrie ain't going to be there. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm tripping. But I don't feel like Kyrie going to be there. And now you expect Kyrie show up to roll games. All right, cool, I'll holler at y'all. Yeah, whatever. What you think, Kyrie gonna come to the airport when you got a back-to-back, like a game at home, then you gotta jump on a plane to go somewhere else? You think Kyrie gonna show up and then y'all roll? You think that's gonna be it? You really think that? Oh, no. None of this was ever an option. Either you were gonna be on the team or you weren't gonna be on the team, period. That's what it was gonna be. And so now we got a team that with Kyrie, you can make the argument is the championship favorite. You can make an argument that without Kyrie, they might even still be the favorites in the East. But what they got is something that I think is like almost worse than Kyrie, like being on the team, not being on the team, whatever. He got to make a hard decision on this. Now, if Kyrie decides tomorrow that he's going to get vaccinated and he shows up, then they're going to welcome him back. And that'll be that. I don't know if Kyrie is honestly in a position where he's able to do that. I don't know if that's an option for him on this. And the reason I say I don't know if it's an option for him is he's so knee deep in this. This is so much now, let him tell it, a matter of principle, that I just don't feel like he'll be able to easily just be like, oh, okay, I changed my mind. No, he's dug in too deep in this. And the narcissism that is present is not the type that allows you to reconsider on this. He says that this is a cause. He says that he is doing it for everybody. If he stops doing it for himself, what he is doing in effect is now telling all these people that he told to stand strong. All right, no more strong standing. No more of that. Go to work. It's not going to work. It's not going to happen. And so the Nets wind up in this situation where this is the guy that you signed up for. And where I want to watch where this goes and where I think that this winds up, for me at least, being a bit interesting is this. Kyrie and Kevin Durant signed up to do this thing together. And, you know, from what we've heard, Durant feels, I don't even know if loyalty is the right word, but Kyrie helped put this whole thing together, right? Like, that was his dude. And Kevin Durant is not going to get up in public and obliterate Kyrie Irving. That's just not it. That's not how he's built. That's not something that I believe that he would find to be appropriate. That's not something he's going to do. It's not going to happen. But that don't mean he ain't mad. Like, if I was him, I would be furious. Like, if you read the tea leaves on everything that's around the Nets, they all figured, well, you know, Kyrie's going to do this Kyrie stuff, and then he's going to come around at some point, and he's going to ultimately get this done. Like, I mean, that seemed to be the thing that all of them believed. And, you know, that would be a reasonable belief if you were dealing with a reasonable person, but it doesn't sound like we're dealing with a reasonable person. But as frustrated as Kevin Durant might be with this, Kevin Durant still has two championships and two finals MVPs. A lot of what we talk about now from here on out with Kevin Durant is gravy. Like, if Kevin Durant and the Nets were to win a championship this year and then Durant wound up being the finals MVP, he would be three-time champion, three-time finals MVP, which for what it's worth would be equal to LeBron James. I don't know if that's something Kevin Durant cares about. Like, if you ask me to guess, as someone who doesn't actually know the dude, if you ask me to guess, I don't think he cares that much about that, right? Like, I think it might be a little driving something, but I don't think necessarily that he cares. He might, but I don't think necessarily that he cares about this, because I don't know how much that's going to change his quote-unquote reputation or quote-unquote legacy. Like, ask yourself this in your mind: if Kevin Durant gets to the same level of championships and finals MVPs as LeBron James, are you going to think that he's a better player than LeBron James? Like, what would it take for you to think that Kevin Durant's a better player than LeBron James? I'm not saying that he is or isn't. I'm not saying that there aren't arguments on both sides. I'm just saying I don't feel like a championship for Durant is going to be the thing that changes it. However, there's another dude on that team named James Harden who has no championships. And the way that we view James Harden would change greatly if he won a championship. Now, I don't think it would have the same impact on the way we view him that it did for Paul Pierce or Kevin Garnett or Dirk Nowitzki, who are like the three guys that I can think of off top, where winning that championship was like, okay, now everything's different in the way that we view them, right? I don't think it would do the same thing for Harden just because Harden has been so good in the ways that we watched him. Like, I think he's largely a foreign being in our minds. However, that dude wants to win a championship. I don't have any question about that. He wants to win a championship. He left a team where he was basically the king. He ran everything in Houston. He got the ball whenever he wanted, all of that stuff. He left that to dial back how much he had the ball, to dial back how much he got to shoot to win a championship. This is really interfering with the whole we're trying to win a championship thing. This is not good. This ain't what anybody wants it to be. Nobody. And so what do you do now? Because I think it's hard to keep goodwill under circumstances like this. It's hard. It's really hard. Let me tell you something else about this Kyrie thing that I myself personally find to be interesting. I keep hearing all these stories about Kyrie confiding in people about what he's thinking and what's on his mind. And they say in this particular case that Kyrie has told close teammates this whole thing that he's working with, right? He's told close teammates how he feels. He's doing this for the culture. You know, he's doing this for everybody else. He's told close teammates that. Not once in any of these stories have I heard anybody looking at Kyrie and saying, that's the dumbest shit I've ever heard in my life. Is there not one person who surrounds him, whether he be somebody that play for the Nets, somebody in his family, anywhere, nobody to look at him and be like, dog, this sounds dumb. Like, it sounds like Stephen A. Smith would be willing to do it, but it also sounds like Kyrie don't take his phone calls no more. There's not a single person, apparently, when he gets out here and says this cockamamie stuff, to look back at him and be like, yo, you know how to spell cockamamie? I just want to write it down and put it on a sheet of paper and hold it in your face so that whenever you say something that's cockamamie to me, I can just break it out and just say, yo, hashtag cockamamie. Because this is cockamamie. This is nonsense. This is ridiculous. And this is where we are. Like, I am hearing people try to make the argument that, like, you know, and it's been said that if Kyrie were to get traded, then there's a chance that Kyrie will retire. And maybe even he's willing to retire over a vaccine mandate. I'm not really sure. This is my thought about that. Really a question. I'm curious about this. I'm trying to think of when a star player has retired and you looked up and were like, wow, what a dumb reason to do that. Right? Like, these cats should just really be able to get out here and retire whenever it is that they want. They got the bread. They're not broke. They got the money in order to get through whatever it is that they want to do. They fine there, right? They don't need it like that. But I can't think of one time that somebody has retired from playing sports and you heard the rationale and were like, wow, that doesn't seem very smart at all. Can you think of one? Can you think of one? Right. And so it's with that in mind that I say that if Kyrie chose to retire over this, it would be the dumbest retirement of all time. Like Ben Simmons over there with his thing. I never thought that Ben Simmons was going to retire, but I did think Ben Simmons potentially would not go back to Philadelphia. But Ben Simmons has gone back to Philadelphia. And I got to admit, I thought that was pretty silly. I didn't think it was very smart. I thought it was poor strategy. Right. But there was a logic to what Ben Simmons was out here doing. Again, I didn't think the strategy was going to work, but I did see where he was coming from. There was, in fact, logic. Where the logic here? Where the logic? Where the good sense? Do you see good sense? I don't see good sense. I don't. And on top of that, when Kyrie makes his decision to come back, hopefully for the Nets, it's before the first game that he goes ahead and makes that call. And the reason I say hopefully it's that, because if he does it before the first game, then everybody got a little bit of time to get over it. But after that, man, the cat's going to be salty. They're not going to be happy to see you. They're not going to be like, oh, cool, as long as we got Kyrie back. Because you know Kyrie ain't going to come back and be quiet about it. You know that. Kyrie going to come back, and who knows? He's going to have something to say. He's going to be doing these crazy interviews. He's going to get some brand new Ankh earrings. He's going to be ready for this. All of it, man. Every single bit of it. I wouldn't be surprised he come back with a tattoo on his face. You know what I'm saying? I really got no idea. I really don't. But this is where we are, man. This is where it is. The most, I can't believe this is happening story in sports. that I can think of. I really can't, because it's just, it's so 2021, man. It's so 100% 2021 in so many ways. And I am just like a lot of other people. I do this. You have to preface a lot of things with Kyrie to be like, he means well. But part of the reason why I do that is I'm not falling for the game. Like, I fully understand it. There's a lot of white folks out here who work in this game that look at Kyrie and want to hold him up as being so stupid and find a way to put a black face on anti-vax and all of that stuff, right? Like, I did CNN yesterday. I did Chris Cuomo's show. And they had sent me an email in production. And I'm not saying they was being racist about this, just to be clear, but you'll understand where I'm coming from and why I see it this way. And they're like, yo, so what's the thing with athletes and anti-vax? And I was like, it's nothing. 96% of the guys are vaccinated. This is one person. But the move is to try to take Kyrie and to make him representative of this whole other thing. So like, I'm on there and I'm like, look, Kyrie is just one of one. But I also don't want to participate in this game where we all just beat up on Kyrie Irving about this, when you and I know damn well we could probably go find a baseball player to feel the exact same way. But baseball players ain't famous, and baseball players more likely to be white. We don't go over there and do that with them in the way that we're doing it with Kyrie. And again, part of it with Kyrie is this persona that he has created. You know what I mean? Like, he has created this. He has made himself a target. But it's for that reason that I and people like me find it important to be like, he means well. And he does legitimately mean well. But he wouldn't be the first narcissist to mean well. And to me, this is very narcissistic behavior, right? Like, all of this is, I can change the world by doing this. Fool, no, you cannot. Like, he really believes that he individually can be that guy. And you're not that good of a basketball player. You're not that famous of a basketball player. And if you're going to stand for these people, stand for these people. Get on your feet and stand. Raise your voice if that is what you feel like you should do. And the truth is, from where I'm coming from, if he feels like this is something that is a legitimate injustice, then do it. Get up here and stand on it. I will respect the fact that you did that, because in the end, you ain't hurting nobody but yourself and the Brooklyn Nets. You're not hurting the world. Like, if you decided that, like, yo, this is something I'm not going for. Like, I don't think that government overreach arguments are far-fetched. Right? I wouldn't draw the line here, but I don't think in general that the concept is so terribly far-fetched. But say something. And that's what so many of these cats bother me. Andrew Wiggins, I got on him about this on his podcast. I said, I ain't never heard nobody say they was fighting for what they believed in with less conviction than Andrew Wiggins. But you know what, though? He sat up there and he answered those questions, and he gave whatever clarity he could to where he was coming from. He did that. Kyrie got to do that. I ain't trying to hear this. It's a private decision. You can't be the voice and make it a private decision. That's not possible. Once you decide you're going to be the voice, your privacy on this matter is gone. You got to stand up and you got to say something. But he's not, because he's Kyrie. And I don't know what the hell to think. But I know this. I wouldn't want to work with him. I don't give a damn how good he is at his job. All right, it is our time of week where we have a guest joining us, and on with us now, he is the executive director of the NFL Players Association. You may have heard his name in the news in the last few days. Damar Smith, how are you, sir?
Awesome, brother. You know, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
No, I appreciate it, man. Now, my first question for you is, how were you made aware of John Gruden's emails about you?
I was made aware that there was actually a coach that had said some things that were racist about me. And then I got a call from the Wall Street Journal about that, asked to make a comment. And that was basically it. You know, it's never great to, you know, have a reporter call you to say that someone else said something about you. I mean, the flip side of it is probably will not be the last time. Certainly was the first time. But the journal calling was a little bit of a stark thing.
Now, one thing that was interesting about it is the timing also overlapped with a vote with the Players Association involving you as executive director. And the first person I sent it to hit me back, and their immediate thought was that the PA had leaked this in order to take attention away from that. But it sounds like you found out about this about the same time everybody else did.
Well, I mean, I probably found out about it a little bit before because they called for a quote.
Right.
I've got enough things going on than that. And I also think that choosing to have someone or to disclose that someone called you a racist is never a great day. Right. So why? Anyway, I can only let people think what they want to think.
Right. Now, my thought when that came across, when I saw what Gruden had actually said was that it was like just really kind of old timey racism. Like, I didn't know people, like, I was aware that racism was still here, but I didn't know that that was the style, that, you know, that the racism was still coming down the pike in. And for me, and I was curious just how you felt about it, I saw it and was like, it is offensive, but it's so out the box. It's not like I'm personally offended, but I have a recognition of how offensive this is. Is that kind of a similar place to where you were?
I was in a place where, you know, you get told who's on the email chain and it's people I know and people I've talked to. And really, Bomani, my only frame was, wow, they seem to be really comfortable talking about this on email. That was really kind of my takeaway. I mean, I hear you about sort of the old time trope frame of this. It's a gross caricature, you know, that you and I would have expected from the 50s maybe or the 60s. But I guess my only takeaway really was, it's a group of people who are on an email chain, or at least, you know, there's a group of people on there feeling pretty comfortable about saying things. And, you know, for me, you know, my first thought really was, if this story is going to run, I've got to talk to my family. So that was really it.
Right. Now, you put out a pretty extensive statement just about what this meant and what this represented for Black people in power as they, you know, navigate through these worlds. Because I think one thing that's interesting, especially about the NFL and the NBA, and I guess now Major League Baseball also, where all the players' associations are headed by Black men. Like, this is a pretty significant level of power that involves a back and forth. Oh, see, the NBA is led by a Black woman, but it leads to a dynamic where, and I imagine in these cases, commissioners and owners are dealing with Black people in professional settings in ways that they had not necessarily before. Now, you've been a U.S. attorney before, which is like the most powerful person in the world. It don't matter what you look like. They got to respect the U.S. attorney. U.S. attorney has a jurisdiction that is kind of unsurpassed. You and I have even talked about that. If you're on the other side of that table, it feel like it. I assure you of that part. But for you, what was the change like going from that line of work into this, where you're dealing with people who just have absolutely no familiarity with dealing with a Black person that they have to treat as some sort of peer or equal?
That's a real issue. When I was running for this job, it was, he's the outsider, he doesn't have a chance, yada, 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 doesn't know sports. Coming into this business, it's starkly different than what we can just call the outside world of professional business. And you know this because you have a foot in both, right? On the one side of the outside world, there are structures, boards, codes of conduct, adherence to either the SEC or the Federal Trade Commission or the EEOC. There are generally rules by which lawyers as a profession agree to adhere to. Inside of corporations, there are codes of conduct. When you get into the sports world, there really isn't that same structure or paradigm of either codes of conduct by which we all agree that we're going to abide by, but also the compliance mechanisms aren't in sports the way that they are in both private practice and government work. I mean, there's a little bit of a difference of the type of personnel, but that's just different. And as a result, I mean, let's just set this to the side for a second. You and I have been talking about GMs asking rookies at the combine questions that no prospective employer is allowed to ask.
Right.
Prospective employees. We've talked about things that have happened at teams that if it happened at a corporation, there would be an internal investigation, there would be mass firings, we would move on. That's not only not the culture of sport, it's not the paradigm of sport. And I know that some people, you know, absolutely lose their minds that I talk about this as a business and the need for us to think about it and approach it like a business. But the things that you're talking about are two of the sort of critical things that are just vastly different than in any other business. And as a result, I think a couple things happen. One, there's this culture that we can do or say things in this box, and somehow we're divorced from complying with norms or what's fair or what's more likely to achieve justice or equality because it's football. And you know, whether it's football, basketball, or anything else, how many times do you hear, yeah. But that, you know what, Bomani, that's just sports, right? That's just the way we work. And it doesn't have to be that way. It just simply doesn't. And I know that sport was an incredible part of my life, both in college and in high school. I'm certainly not nearly the talent of the people who play professionally, but I believe that this opportunity for people to engage in sport and for people to absorb vital lessons and morality plays and entertainment from this thing called sport is tremendous. It's wonderful. I just don't think that it has to be coexistent with the more horrible things that we've tried to eradicate out of our past. And it's not just racism. It's misogyny. It's homophobia. It's just not treating people in a way that you would want your kids to be treated. We saw that with the U.S. gymnast. How does an organization ignore their pleas for help? You know, we were on the Costa show. We talked about it a little bit. You have a group of extremely young women who go to college to pursue their dream. They are assaulted by a predator and no one responds to their calls of help. And that's something that, you know, hopefully a lot of other people are going to unpack. But at some root level, someone kind of made the decision, well, you know, that's sports. We don't need the same compliance structure. We don't need the same level of accountability. And it's false. It's just false.
Now, with this particular situation, the reports have been that John Gruden has reached out to you. Are those true?
He did. And, you know, I texted John back after he called on Saturday. I texted him and said, hey, I know you've got a game to coach. Let's get in touch later on in the week. You know, that was before Monday. At some point, I'm sure we'll talk.
Now, one thing I had wondered about this is this investigation that had taken place. I think the football team in Washington had to pay a $10 million fine to the NFL. Dan Snyder gave up day-to-day control for a period of time. But while this investigation was going on, did the NFL Players Association have any involvement in that? Was there any inquiry made toward you guys? Was that strictly an NFL matter?
Strictly an NFL matter.
Now the NFLPA is saying that you would like to have all of those emails released. Are there any legal grounds for that to be done, or is that merely a request?
It's a request. I'm far more interested in the conversations between coaches and GMs that would suggest that there hasn't been a level of fairness, or there hasn't been a culture in the highest ranks of coaching and player management that matches what the league has said about it not being closed to players of color or hiring in the coaching ranks. I have less of a concern, honestly, about this being directed at just the Washington football team stuff. What I'm interested in is there correspondence that suggest that teams are making decisions about coaches based on the color of their skin? Are they actively hostile to players who have chosen to self-identify in various ways? Are they denigrating people based on sexual preference or religious identity? I'm not so much interested in just, I want to know about Washington football. I'm not. I think it would be good for our game and for our business for both the league and the union to decide that we're going to turn a corner. And we've talked about diversity. We've talked about inclusiveness for years. How do we turn the corner and actually match our actions to our words? And when will we start to hold people accountable for living up to a standard that we believe is the acceptable standard for just human interaction? But to me, Bomani, the real winner here is there are few things as potentially beautiful and pure as human competition. I mean, I'm not slighting anybody who likes to watch Robot Wars. I'm just not that guy, right? But man, you know, how many times do you, you know, where you sit and the things that you do, have this wonderful window into the capacity that people have for greatness, for competition, for teamwork, for sacrifice, for excellence, for committing yourself to a goal. I mean, all of these things that we want to teach our kids about the beauty of sport, what better way of trumpeting or placing those ideals on a pedestal than to say that all of this other stuff that takes away from that, let's turn a corner and try to set up a world where we're not going to stand for those things. And to me, that's how you preserve, enhance, and really build upon the beauty of sport, whether it's football, basketball, women's handball, swimming, gymnastics, whatever. All of those things are beautiful in and of themselves, and they deserve not to be sullied by the lesser angels of our nature.
Now, in the last week, have you had any conversations with the NFL about how to move toward that?
Yeah, I mean, Roger and I have talked. I'll, you know, for now, kind of keep those conversations, you know, between us. And I think that it's something that I know we'll talk about going forward.
Well, one interesting thing about Roger Goodell to me is he's got that job and he works with these owners. But I have always felt that, like, in his own desires, that these are things that he also cares about, too. Has that been the impression that you've gotten from your dealing with him over the years?
Roger and I have had a difficult and an interesting relationship over, you know, nearly 13 years. And we've had our battles, certainly, but we've also done some pretty amazing things together, I think. You know, I think that, for example, being the only business probably in the country to get through COVID the way that we did, those conversations had a lot of depth to them about sort of the moral and ethical things, the moral and ethical decisions that we had to make about playing in a pandemic. And we both wrestled with those things. We probably didn't always agree, but I will say that I found a person who was willing to embrace and walk through the difficult moral, ethical issues that were on our plate. And do I think that that's the same person that is going to deal with these issues? Yes. So I'm sure that there's going to be things that we disagree with tomorrow. But I do feel that having gone through such a difficult mental and philosophical journey leading up to the season, you know, last year, I do think that he understands, appreciates, and is sensitive to the concrete ethical things that I think that we need to confront.
Now, what have you heard from your membership since all of this popped off on Friday?
I talked to our guys, and certainly a lot of guys have reached out. Again, you probably know I never talk about my conversations with players. And I'm thrilled, really, for the friends who have reached out, you know, people that I probably haven't heard from in 20 years. Because, you know, this isn't just football. For people who find themselves, for people who come from diverse backgrounds or find themselves in the minority on any basis, deal with this duality of this is who I am and this is where I'm being asked to work. And how do I deal with all of the issues that ping pong back and forth between those two poles of that duality? And it's not easy. You're constantly struggling with how do I not sacrifice who I am in order to be successful given what I'm being asked to do? When do the things that I'm being asked to do conflict with who I am? And then the third thing is how you're being perceived. And so the interesting thing, Bomani, I've heard probably equally from both my peers and people who are, let's just say younger than me, who are grasping, you know, with this thing every day, seeing this play out the way that it is, and looking for some guidance, direction, hope. What do you tell them? You tell them that this isn't going to be the last time.
Now, Drew Brees was a member of the executive committee of the Players Association. He was a named plaintiff in the decertification lawsuit of 2011. He is now on Sunday Night Football, and it was time for Sunday Night Football to discuss this matter. Drew Brees was literally nowhere to be found. Were you surprised that he did not have anything to say given that platform and his role with the Players Association?
Well, I'll just be dead honest with you. I didn't watch Sunday Night Football, so this is the first I'm hearing of it. Drew has always been a tremendous leader for us. He was on the executive committee that hired me back in 2009. You said, you know, he's a named plaintiff. You know, I don't have any doubts about where Drew Brees is on this. I don't know what the setup was for Sunday Night Football. This is the first time I'm hearing about it. But Drew has always been a stand-up guy for this union at a time when we don't typically have a lot of quarterbacks who step up for the union. You know, he took it upon himself to help find an executive director after Gene Upshaw passed away. I wouldn't envy any of those guys who were in that situation. You know, guys like Mike Vrabel, guys like Brian Dawkins. So I don't know what the plan was for Sunday Night Football. I don't have any doubts about where Drew is on his union, and I don't have any doubts about where Drew is on what he thinks is right.
So where do you think that this all goes from here? Because it's interesting, all the, you know, this, as you said, is an NFL matter. This investigation was an NFL matter. But because the first story to come out involved you, we now come to talk to you about it. But where do you think this all goes? I mean, this is a lot of emails and an interesting window, perhaps, into what goes on with the NFL.
I think the first place that it can't go, I don't think we can explain away racism, homophobia, and misogyny. I think that's where it has to start. And while I didn't watch Sunday Night Football, people informed me about what other people said. I think the more we try to offer an apology or a defense of comments like these or feelings like these or thoughts or positions like these, we will never turn the corner. So I think that's the first place it has to start. After that, I think really, regardless of what's in the emails or what happens with the emails, we just have to make a decision about whether NFL football is better than this. And I think NFL football should be better than this. And I think that we shouldn't tolerate people treating other people as less. Just philosophically, that's morally repugnant to me. But the real conversation for our country, and perhaps the opportunity for the NFL, is how do you set an example for how we should interact with people regardless of whether they have a job in sports or not? It's clearly going to be a better conversation, has to be a better conversation. I guess, Bomani, going back to that duality, right? It's like, well, does this mean that every Black executive now has to kick off a conversation about it? That's not fair, right? Why does it have to be the targeted person to then take the reins of trying to fix why they were targeted? That makes no sense to me. It seems to me that what we would want is a mutuality of people realizing that while we've talked about this thing to death, and even when I signed on, there's that section on pronouns, and that's a wonderful way of promoting equality. But we've done a lot to set the standard for what we would expect for a more just, a more fair, and a more equal world. And we've put into place all sorts of things that should ensure that that not only continues, but the pace of it speeds up. None of that is going to work until we just decide that certain conduct and a certain way of thinking about people and categorizing people and reducing people is unacceptable, just unacceptable. And then I think that's how we turn a corner. But, you know, that's probably another generation.
That is Damaris Smith, executive director of the NFL Players Association. I was about to call you the executive producer of the NFL Players Association, like that was a television show. You know, but hey, you get a cut as the producer. Being the executive director doesn't go the same way. And I do have to tell people this, speaking of executive producer, we were doing Back on the Record with Bob Costas, and D. Smith and Michelle Roberts joined us. And before D got there, somebody said, hey, because Ken Burns was there, like, Ken, you need to know, D is going to say something to you. And I was like, whoa, does D Smith have a problem with Ken Burns? D Smith walked in there and fanboyed it out with Ken Burns. He did everything but tussle his hair. It was so genuine. I've never seen somebody so happy to meet somebody that short.
Man, look, that was one of those things that I did walk in the room and it was kind of like, I am so embarrassed. The only way I know how to deal with this is just be the fanboy and apologize in advance. Man, I just love great storytellers. And I don't know if you saw his documentary on Ali.
Oh, yeah.
Halfway through it right now. Watching it with my parents, which is phenomenal. But, you know, one of his documentaries that really just got me through the last couple of years is the documentary on the Vietnam War. And, you know, for us, you know, you go from a certain election to someone calling the players' mothers a word. You go into George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and the litany of people. And then it's the storming of the Capitol and the insurrection and COVID. You and I know, I mean, you could sit and in this span of what, 18 months, feel like the world is tearing apart. And I sat down with my dad and I was just kind of talking about it. And he said, well, let me take you back from 1963 to 1973. And you lose civil rights icons, the assassination of a president, assassination of a candidate, the shooting at Kent State, the Vietnam War, Watergate. And I felt like the world was tearing apart, right? And he and I watched the Ken Burns documentary. And it's, at least for me, it was cathartic because in a few episodes, it encapsulated just how dramatic and at times a free fall we were all in. But our democracy, though battered, survived. But it only did so because we had courageous people, right? That's where we are.
Damaris Smith, thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.